This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross.
Soft you! A word or two before you go. I have done the state some service, and they know it. No more of that. I pray you in your letters, when you shall these unlucky deeds relate, speak of me as I am. Nothing extenuate, nor set down aught in malice.
The final speech of Othello and the magnificent voice of Paul Robeson. Shakespeare's Moor was perhaps his most famous role, but Robeson the actor is also remembered as the personification of Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones, and he stopped the show when he sang Old Man River in Showboat. Paul Robeson was a renowned concert performer, too, who based his repertoire in spirituals, but came to include a wide range of folk and classical music. He was one of the great artists of the 20th century and among the most controversial. Paul Robeson Jr. has written a biography of his famous father called The Undiscovered Paul Robeson. This volume covers the period from his birth in 1898 to 1939. It reminds us that he first came to national attention as an athlete. Paul Robeson was an All-American end for Rutgers College, maybe the best football player in the country in 1917 and 1918. Here's a reading from the book that describes how he had to overcome the racism of his own teammates before he could even make the varsity.
He had made a clean, hard tackle and momentarily lay face down with his arms outstretched to catch his breath. Just then, passing by on his way back to the huddle, a varsity halfback named Frank Kelly deliberately stomped on the fingers of Paul's right hand. The bones didn't break, but the pain was excruciating. Enraged even more by the insult than by his pain, Paul leapt to his feet. But he did not attack Kelly. Instead, he harnessed the immense energy of his anger and coiled his body in preparation for the next play. In his mind, he focused on avenging an insult not just to himself, but to the entire black race. The next play was run directly at him, with Kelly carrying the ball. Paul uncoiled, hurling aside the blockers, and drove his shoulder into the onrushing Kelly with a thump heard across the practice field. Then, in a single coordinated motion, he planted his feet widely, wrapped his arms tightly around Kelly, and with an explosive effort heaved Kelly up over his head. He was in full control of his rage, but only he knew that. His murderous body language and facial expression frightened all the onlookers who feared he might kill Kelly. Coach Sanford screamed the first thing that came into his mind, "Robeson, you're on the varsity." Paul silently dropped the terrified halfback to the ground and stalked off the field holding his injured hand. He recalled this incident as a symbol of the savagery of America's popular culture. At the time, he experienced a liberating revelation. It was as if he had used the energy of his rage to convince a group of hostile white men that he might kill at least one of them in self-defense if they attacked him. For the first time in his life, he had cast off his father's cautionary strictures about never angering white people. At last, he had been able to savor the heady feeling of siding with his rebellious brother, Reed. And that was a defining moment which he repeated to me over and over. Not afraid to die. And in the end, if you have to save your life, not afraid to kill.
You talked about his father's teachings. His father, a minister in Princeton, New Jersey, who was later lost his job as a result of politics in Princeton and racism, and then finally got another pastor at this time in the AME Zion Church. But he insisted that Paul, and I'm quoting you here, he insisted that Paul must never appear to be challenging the claim of white superiority. Climb up if you can, he would say, but always show you are grateful. Above all, do nothing to give them cause to fear you. Was this an expression of someone who was himself vastly more familiar with slavery and someone who was experiencing at that very time the rash of lynchings throughout the country.
That's absolutely correct. But from generation to generation, there are those who, like my grandfather, Paul's father, took that tack, and as a people, we had to take that tack in order to survive. But there always have been those who, at the right time in the right place, have defied white superiority. There's not only Frederick Douglass, after all, there was Nat Turner. And my father was a little bit Nat Turner. There's a place and a time. So at that moment was the first time in his life that he went beyond his father's limitations, and he never went back. That is, metaphorically, not literally, of course, he never went back to this fear of, I can't go right against the system. He, from then on, when he felt it was the right time, was capable to conquer both fear and anger, and in a disciplined way, challenge the whole scheme of things.
Despite his experience of racism, and that one incident you told us about was hardly the only one, he was regarded as apolitical when he was first in living in Harlem. But you take care to point out that in those early years, it wasn't that he was not paying attention. He was listening to people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, listening and learning, do you think?
Learning and choosing. For example, philosophically, he identified with W.E.B. Du Bois. He rejected outright the nationalism of Garvey, and he rejected outright the assimilationist views of James Weldon Johnson and subsequent assimilationists. So he was making choices at the time, and as an artist, he felt in the 20s, certainly, and into the early 30s, the way to make his point was through culture and not through political debate. Mm-hmm. He was very political, if you think of culture as political. He redefined the black male image, for example, in the theater, from a caricature to a human being. He made the spiritual an art form, accepted art form in America, and he embodied the traditions of the black working class as distinct from the traditions of the black middle class, entrepreneurial class. So he even then, culturally speaking, was engaging in what a Marxist might call the class struggle, only not explicitly. He felt, and besides, he was not a movement person. He was an inspirer. He wasn't an organizational person. Let's say like Martin Luther King. He came to sing at meetings, not to make speeches. Seems like a contradiction, but it isn't when you think about it.
Paul Robeson Jr. is the author of The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, the first of what will be a two-volume biography. We're going to take a short break now. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Robeson Jr. His new biography of his famous father is The Undiscovered Paul Robeson. It's subtitled An Artist's Journey, 1898 to 1939. As a young man, still studying law at Columbia University, Paul Robeson took his first roles on stage and found his voice singing spirituals.
Deep river, my home is over Jordan.
Deep River, recorded in 1926, sung by Paul Robeson with his longtime accompanist and collaborator Lawrence Brown on piano. Paul Robeson Jr., this was in the middle of the jazz age. Weren't spirituals more than a little bit out of fashion?
Indeed they were, specifically among black people, certainly among the black middle class, who felt you're supposed to be singing lieder and classical things like all the other European concert singers to prove that you can do this. These are just sort of folk songs. It's too crude. You shouldn't be doing that, Paul. It's embarrassing. It's fascinating that he converted in his first concert tour the black middle class to re-enter their own culture and identify once again with the spirituals, because he sang them with such originality as they were meant to be sung. He sort of reclaimed an important part of American culture.
He was also criticized by some black performers who said he was doing this the wrong way. He wasn't listening to Debussy when he was singing spirituals.
That's correct. And he simply said this is an original folk art which is as important artistically as Bach, Debussy, or any other music, and pointed out that the greatest composers, including Bach, Debussy, and Mozart, and many others, used folk themes and folk music as the basis for their, quote, more sophisticated music.
Paul Robeson had a lot of trouble throughout this part of his career being torn between the attractions of the commercial world, and he appeared for a while in the great musical review written by U.B. Blake and Noble Sissel, Shuffle Along, for example. This is not something you associate with Paul Robeson.
Well, that's very much a significant point. His early career was the conflict of remaining pure to his cultural traditions and getting on the performing artist's radar screen in the country. If you got no audience, mm-hmm. you might as well be singing on the street corner. So that was an immense conflict. What does one do? Well, he made the obvious compromises in order to get on the map. He did Shuffle Along as a means for not only making money, but getting on the radar screen, so mm-hmm. to speak. His point was that where did he want to go? Did he want to continue to be a big star in vaudeville and go on to musical shows and whatnot, or did he want to go into the classical theater and the classical concert stage? He chose the latter and used the former only as a way to get his foot in the door. His point was, overall, when he looked back, it's not so much the compromises you make on the way up, and he made many. I mean, he sang all kinds of popular songs, including some darky songs, Mammy's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread and things like that, as well as Deep River, in order to become a popular recording artist. Then he had a huge audience to speak to. If he hadn't, he'd had no audience. So he was not at all apologetic about that, even when he was criticized quite sharply in the late 20s, early 20s for that matter, and in the 30s by both the left and the more militant wing of the civil rights movement, and especially by the nationalists. He shrugged that off. He said, you got to get from here to there in steps. The point was, when you become powerful, when you have this huge audience, then you have an obligation to use it for the good and not do this garbage anymore.
One role he did not take, and this almost comes to a shock. You associate the role so much with Paul Robeson, it's almost a shock to realize he was not in the original cast of Showboat.
Correct. And because he didn't like the lyrics and he was trying to get out of it. But then I came along. I was born in 1927. He searched around. He had to make some money. So he took the role when it opened in London and swallowed his pride and sang the lyrics, although he sang it in a different way than it was originally written. He brought his own spin to it, so to speak, and he became an instant star. So that's an example of what I'm saying. Yeah. Mother, by the way, who was very shrewd in these areas and was a great help to him in his early career, said, look, take the doggone part, sing it the way it was, and he turned it down. No, I'm not going to do that. Later on, I quote him in a letter saying to Mother, you are absolutely right. I was a fool not to do some of this stuff. But fortunately, he was very lucky and got the role in London. Of course, the rest is history.
One of the London critics, Paul Robeson, had already appeared on stage in London before this, noted that Robeson not only stole the show, but the production had been contrived to give this enormous stage presence a non-speaking part.
Dad was amazingly adept and skillful at using his body, which was an athlete's body, on stage. And I don't think people are too aware of that dimension of his acting. And part of his training, by the way, as I describe in the book, was his first film was a film made by a black filmmaker named Oscar Michaud called Body and Soul, which was a silent film in which my father had to play two roles in the first film he'd ever done. And he couldn't use his voice. It was silent. So he had to learn to act. And that was really the crucible in which he learned how to use his body and facial expressions as an actor and not rely on his voice.
For some people, your father's legacy will always be tainted by his association with the Soviet Union, a place he never publicly criticized.
Absolutely right.
In the 1930s, even as they're approaching the period of this book, by the 1930s, some of the excesses, if you will, of the Soviet system had certainly come to light.
Call them crimes, which they were. I mean, excesses is kind of a euphemism. What I do in the book is, through his own words, demonstrate once and for all that there's no way anyone can say that he didn't know what was happening during the purges in the Soviet Union or what kind of person Stalin was. He knew chapter and verse. I knew as a 10-year-old going to school with the children of the people being purged. So even a 10-year-old is not blind and deaf. So whatever anybody wants to say, he knew what was going on in the 1930s in the Soviet Union under Stalin. The crimes, not just the excesses. And he never criticized that, then or later. So the only question is, why not?
There you go.
Now, maybe the easiest way is just to read a brief excerpt from the preface where I deal with that. The media-nurtured myth that his political persecution stemmed from a love affair with communism or that he was duped by Russian or American communists has always been aimed at obfuscating his dedication to the goal of immediate and full freedom for his people. The truth is that my father was never a communist, nor did he ever seriously contemplate joining the Communist Party. His defense of the Soviet Union and his refusal to abandon his communist friends did not stem from a fascination with left-wing ideology or from personal pride. Rather, these decisions were based on his love of Russian culture and his conviction that the Soviet Union and communists in general were the most reliable opponents of Nazism, colonialism, and racism. And I might add that communists in the United States and elsewhere, in his view, were the best allies of African Americans, and that was proven throughout history. So that in terms of how you behave, and any African American understood that then and understands it now, you don't criticize your allies when you're fighting your enemy. And for him, the right wing of the United States, the system and the culture developed in the South with slavery and the aftermath was the worst enemy of progressive mankind and of black people specifically outside of Hitler's Nazis, and they were cousins, if not the brothers, of Hitler's Nazis. He believed it. I think history has proved it, and I believe it. There are a lot of people that upsets on the left, never mind on the right. But that is an African-American attitude based on the history of slavery and racism in the U.S. more than, quote, a left-wing attitude.
Paul Robeson, Jr., more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Robeson, Jr. He's the author of a new book, The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, the first of a two-volume biography of his father. Tell us, the growing up as the son of a famous man is not the easiest thing in the world. This couldn't have been, by no stretch of the imagination, did you have anything approaching what anybody would call a normal childhood?
No, you're quite right about that. But one thing I'll tell you, it certainly was not dull. It certainly was not dull. I mean, it was one hell of a trip in one sense. Yes, there was I missed him a lot when I was a little kid because he wasn't around much. He was on tour. I was being taken care of by my grandmother.
It's interesting you say your first memory of your father is, in fact, his voice coming out of a Victrola.
Exactly. And I guess the next one was one day, I must have been, I don't know, maybe I wasn't barely 2 years old, but anyway, I remember vaguely even today, one day that the voice came from up there somewhere above my head. It wasn't the usual place, and there's this huge shoe there, you know, the 14 times 14, and you know, at a 2-year-old level, I put it together. Oh, hey, that's the real one. And my only vague memory is just this wonderful sound of this deep, gentle voice and these huge hands, which were very gentle, and then this big smile and the big eyes with a lot of this wonderful, benevolent image and feeling. So there was a great feeling of security. At the same time, I was would get pretty angry at him as a little kid. He's never around, you know. Little kids, my father, I own him. Who the heck is the Prince of Wales or Nehru or somebody? Who's hell? I'm number one here. Dad.
Standing, the universe centers right here.
Right, right. So he was a very fun guy to be around.
The experience of being separated that much from your parents, you must have understood that they were special, and that I guess in a way you were too.
That's true, but one thing he gave me is a sense of myself. Looking back, it's over an entire lifetime. His point was, do whatever you want to do. Don't copy anybody else, and especially don't copy me. He had a great sense of humor. So he said, well, you know, if you want to sing and act, great, but you're not going to beat me at Othello or Old Man River. Do something, you know. don't try to beat me at that. So he always gave, not just me, but other people, a sense of themselves. He was, in that sense, an emotional empowerer rather than sort of an awe-inspiring suppressor, as many, quote, great, unquote, people are.
You did eventually follow his steps onto the football field, at least. You must have had many temptations to try to go on stage or sing.
No, I never wanted any part of that. I mean, the price he paid for being an artist and a public figure, the personal price he paid in terms of giving up a personal life, I was never ready to do for any reason. Even political. And in some ways, as an organizational political person, I was more political than he. But I wasn't about to sacrifice my personal life in the way he had to do what he did. I guess it was from, you know, seeing the price that the family paid, not just him, but especially him.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, he had to live up to a living legend, and that is he had to live up to a public which expected him to be bigger than life. There is no such thing as bigger than life, as he would impress upon me often. So that's an immense burden. And he said when he retired and became what people said, well, he's a recluse. No, he had had enough of being a public figure, and he wasn't about to be someone's wise elder and some kind of living icon. He'd done his job, he'd finished, and he wasn't about to give up one second of his private life after his retirement. So I remember him saying when he was about 60, you know, I hope I don't live to be an old man. I have a heart attack or something and go quickly because I wouldn't know how to be an old man after my public career is gone, because nobody would accept me as just a person who's not some kind of icon. So, in a sense, he sacrificed being able to be old. I wasn't willing to do that. Very few people You see, only people who have a divine mission like a Robeson or a King or a Malcolm, Latter-day Malcolm, or a Frederick Douglass or a Nat Turner, I'm not quite up to that. I have to say, very few people are.
Paul Robeson Jr., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Robeson Jr. is the author of The Undiscovered Paul Robeson.